come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together we get better. In person, January 12th to 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, food, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories covering all aspects of eating disorders, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, boutique, shop till you drop, and much more. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night, book your room now at a discounted rate through oabirthday.com website. Act fast, rooms sell out quickly. Why? There is a solution. You will hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease and who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together we get better.
We ask that you keep the focus on your recovery in this 12-step program, Overeaters Anonymous. Qualify until 9:30. You'll get a 5-minute warning. All right. Hi, I'm David. I'm a compulsive overeater, bulimic. Really, really great to be here. Just to qualify, I came into Overeaters Anonymous 15 years ago. I was 21 years old. I was living in Manhattan. I was suicidal, failing out of college. Hadn't seen my dad in a decade. Had never been in a real relationship. And I was binging my way through every single Whole Foods in New York City every day, calorie counting on my phone, and then going down to my gym and just exercising until the calories that I binged matched the calories on the treadmill. And I was taking 15 pills of hydroxycut every day. My heart was just always beating out of my chest, and half a bottle of NyQuil every night just to sleep. And I was just on this cycle of incomprehensible demoralization. And I would promise myself tomorrow's going to be different. And by 11 o'clock the next day, I'd be in a bagel shop in New York, like binging, and then I'd end up on the Whole Foods cycle again. And I just couldn't get off of it. I just couldn't stop. And, you know, as a raging bulimic, I knew where every good bathroom was in New York City to purge in. And I just, the most important thing in my life was eating and then getting rid of it. That's just what my life is all about. So I came in 15 years ago with just really at a complete bottom. And it took me 2 years to get abstinent. And just to qualify, I've been abstinent for 13 years as of November. And my abstinence is no binging, no purging, no flour, no sugar. And it's funny, I went on a date a couple nights ago, and the conversation of sugar came up, and the woman was like, "You haven't had sugar in 13 years?" And for me, it's not even a question anymore. It's just not my food. I have no compulsion to eat it. I have no desire to eat it. And when I got here, I couldn't go an hour without sugar. It was just like my crutch, and it was my drug, and I couldn't go without it. And I owe everything to Overeaters Anonymous. So to talk a little bit about what it was like, I grew up on Long Island. My dad was a very prominent doctor on Long Island, and my mom is an early childhood trauma psychologist. So you would never think that what was happening inside my family was happening. But what I've learned about addiction and alcoholism and mental illness and abuse, it doesn't matter how much money you have or your socioeconomic background or what schools you went to or cars you drove. Like, this is a disease and it doesn't matter who it takes. And my family, I come from a line of overeaters and addicts and bipolar and mental illness. And by the time it got to my family dynamic was, my mom was very mentally ill. My dad was this big guy and he was abusive. I have an older sister who's an addict who was like the provoker in my family. And then I was the little Al-Anon referee. So my dad would come home from work and he would go into these rage blackouts and would just rage through the house. And it was terrifying as a kid. And I always share like the first memory that I have of childhood. My dad was raging through the house and we had this three-story house and he like made it upstairs chasing my sister and he got her and like threw her up against the wall and he was grabbing her by her chins, calling her a fat pig. And I like came to the rescue as a five-year-old and I like jumped on my dad's back and I'm trying to like get my dad off my sister and he grabbed me and like threw me up against the wall. And I remember I looked across, we had this long hallway and my mom was standing in the doorway of her bedroom. And I was like crying and screaming for her and begging for her to help us. And I don't know, at times in this memory, she had a drink in her hand. Other times she just closed the door. I don't really know because I have trauma, but what I remember is she wasn't there for me and she didn't protect us. And I think she went into her room and closed the door, but it doesn't even matter the facts. What was programmed in me was it's every man for himself. It's fight or flight. I can't trust my parents. My dad's going to hurt me. My mom's not going to protect me. And I'm all alone. Like I'm just a lost child in an airport. And my dad's abuse kept getting worse. And there were nights the cops would come and it got really, really bad, and he ended up losing custody. And I was never I don't remember ever eating compulsively when the abuse was happening, or living in that trauma. I just don't remember being in the food as a young, young kid. But when he lost custody, I started becoming terrified that he was going to come and take me and my sister and like kidnap us and throw us in the, like, you know, I was a kid and I had these crazy fantasies that he was gonna like throw us in a swamp and murder us. And he would like do really crazy things. He would like follow my bus home from school, or he'd sit in the bleachers during sports practice, like really scary stuff. And there were some nights where he would like try to break into our house and I slept with a baseball bat under my bed. It was just terrifying. And that's when I went to the food. It wasn't around the abuse. It was around the anxiety that something bad was going to happen. I've always eaten over the future worry that, like, the shoe's going to drop or something bad's going to happen around the corner. And I remember, like, it started coming home from school, just eating ice cream. And just feeling like calm, like safe and protected and okay, I'm okay, I can breathe. And as a young kid, I just crossed the invisible line at a really young age. From like 7 to 12, I just became this sugar addict. And quickly, I was 60 pounds overweight and I became the fat kid in school. And, you know, anybody who is the fat kid in school, it was horrible. Like, I got picked on. I was bullied every day. It was just like torment as a kid, just being picked on for being fat. And I didn't have like a family where I'd come home and my mom was like, "So, how was your day, sweetheart? Like, tell me about your feelings." Like, I just remember, I don't ever remember family dinners. Like, I remember, like, taking cookie dough and putting it in a big bowl and like mashing it up and like taking it up to my bedroom. Some nights me and my sister would like mash the cookie dough together, but like that was kind of the best that I could do. It was like eating raw cookie dough in my bedroom every night for dinner. Like I didn't have a normal family upbringing. So I would be ashamed that I was fat and that I was getting picked on for being fat. And then I would just keep eating over it. And You know, as a kid growing up in trauma, I didn't like know how to raise my hand in a classroom. I didn't know how to make friends on the playground. I didn't know how to talk to other people. I would have to lie when I did make friends why they couldn't come home or like come over. I was terrified of dogs. I didn't know how to ride a bike. Like, normal child upbringing, I just didn't have. Like, I just didn't live like a normal kid. I just, like, all I remember is growing up in this crazy upbringing and then being in the food and then being fat and then being ashamed and then the food got bigger. And I hated being fat and getting picked on. And you know, you hear different age groups from, you know, I've been in the program now 15 years. I hear a lot when people are 7. Like, that's a really formative year. My parents got divorced when I was 7. And you hear a lot of people come in when, you know, they talk about when they were 7, important things happen. And then from 7 to, like, 14, those were the years where most people had their first kiss or invited their first boyfriend or girlfriend to the dance or, you know, developed friendships or went on vacation. Like, I just didn't have any of those things. And my sister also suffered from this disease. I used to hear her purging every night. We had, like, connecting rooms. And she lost a lot of weight really quickly. And I remember just thinking, like, I want what she has. And one day I went into her bedroom and I went into her, like, pantry, she, like, her bathroom pantry, and I found her diet pills. And I remember just thinking, like, okay, this is going to be my solution. And what started with one diet pill when I was a sophomore in high school, by the time I was a junior in high school, I was taking 15 pills a day. I was addicted to laxatives, and I had lost about 60 pounds in, like, a summer. And I transferred high schools from my sophomore year to my junior year. And I was skinny. And I was, like, attractive to the opposite sex. And I started dating, like, the most attractive girl in my high school. And on the inside, I'm this fat kid who was just in my old school getting picked on every day. And now I'm, like, this cool kid who's dating the pretty girl. And I just didn't know how to reconcile it. But in my head, it was like, I like this attention, and I have to go to any lengths to make sure that I never get fat again. And that programming took me from, by the time I was a junior in high school, the time I was a senior in college, the bulimia just took off. It was a train that just couldn't stop. And, you know, I went to any lengths to keep the weight off. And by the time I was a senior in college, like I said, I was binging my way through Manhattan. I was purging my way through Manhattan, exercising like a maniac every day. And I just couldn't keep the weight off anymore. Like, there was no amount of purging or diet pills that was stopping the weight gain. And when I was 21 years old, I was like, I'm going to take my life. Like, I had no hope. I had no optimism for a future. I knew what I wanted to do for my career, but I had no idea how to nothing was working. And I was like, all right, but I'm going to have one final binge. And I'm going to go to my mom's house on Long Island, and I'm going to binge, and then I'm going to take my life, and the pain is going to end. And it was around, like, November, 15 years ago, and I'm binging my way through my mom's house, so there's all the leftover Halloween candy. And I'm just binging, and I'm doing, like, the crazy mad scientist thing where I'm, like, putting things on the stove and putting sugar on them and liquidating them and putting them in the microwave. And I tore through my mom's kitchen, and then I made my way to her pantry, and as I'm binging through her pantry, the OA 12 and 12, like, fell onto the ground. And one of those, like, crazy movie moments. And I always say the miracle is not that there was a book there, that it fell. My mom was a psychologist, and there were all the 12-step books were in our house. But the miracle, bless you, is that in my binge, I picked it up. And everybody knows what it's like to be, like, a raccoon in a binge. And I picked up the book, and I opened it up, And I remember I read the preamble, and it said something like, "We of Overeaters Anonymous have found in this fellowship a way to recover from the disease of compulsive overeating." And that sentence changed my life, because I thought that I was the only person who had this thing. I didn't know that it was a disease. I didn't know there were rooms to recover in. I didn't know that I wasn't alone. And I went to my sister's apartment the next week, and I said, "I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm a bulimic. I can't stop. I'm suicidal." And she said, "You need to go to OA." And she printed out the New York City meeting list. And it was February, 15 years ago. I went to an AB meeting on the Upper West Side. It was all women. And everything in my head was like, "You don't belong here." But everything in my heart, I don't even know if it was my heart, because I was still so disconnected. But I felt a power greater than myself in that first meeting. And that power every week just kept me coming back. Like, nothing was going to stop me from going to that meeting every week, every Sunday, 4:30 p.m. I was just there. And I was binging in between, but I just kept coming back. And miracles started happening even before I got abstinent, just by being in program and being committed to the keep coming back of it all. I just started getting miracles in my life. And I was failing out of college. I was at my fifth college in 4 years, not even going to class. I was just binging all day. I wasn't like showing up. And by the grace of God, somehow I graduated college and met somebody in my industry who was like a powerhouse in my industry. And she got me into the best graduate program for what I do in the country. And I moved from New York to L.A. And that was a God shot. I moved with like $10 in my bank account and 0 days of abstinence. But I heard later on, like, sometimes you have to get new playgrounds. And L.A. for me, it became about recovery. And this is where OA started. And I started going to meetings every day as I was going through this graduate program. And I would go to a meeting at 8000 Sunset every morning. And I used to hear, like, "Find a sponsor who has what you want and ask him how he or she is achieving it." And I'm like 21, 22, and I had it was like I was on like a dating app. I had a checklist. He needed to drive a nice car, be in the entertainment industry, have a beautiful wife. Like, those are not things that are important to recovery. And I thought I found that person, and he was like, "Sorry, David, I'm full." And I remember I went to the 8000 Sunset morning meeting, and I said, "Nobody wants to sponsor me. Like, poor me, poor me." And this woman came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "David, I'll temporarily sponsor you." And I looked her up and down, and in my head, I'm like, "Hey, no chance in hell." But in my heart, or what came out of me, was like, "Okay, let's try it." And I later found out she didn't have a car. I don't think she had a job. She was a lesbian, and she wasn't married. She was single. She was like everything not on my list. But we started working the steps just before Thanksgiving 13 years ago. And I got abstinent the week that I started working the steps, and I've been abstinent ever since. And in that first year with her, she took the bus from, I don't know where she was even coming from, I think downtown LA, and I was living like near Culver City. She took the bus every week, and we went through the 12 steps together. And by the time I was at my ninth step, I would say 70% of the time, I had been restored to sanity with the food. And I shared about this. I led a meeting in Japan yesterday, and I shared that, you know, there are a lot of different schools of OA. I came from the school of, I was a black or white bulimic, perfectionist. If I'm not going to do it perfectly, I don't want to do it at all. And when I was around my ninth step, I had like 9 months of abstinence. I led this meeting. It was at the Lions Club like 12 years ago, 12 and a half years ago. And I led this meeting, and the meeting was packed. And I had never, you know, I was always scared of talking in front of people. That became a big part of my story. And after the meeting, people were like crying and telling me how impactful my share was. And it just was too much. And I remember I went to Westwood Whole Foods and I had like a lunch at 10:30 in the morning. That was like huge. And I called my sponsor and I was like, I just like kitchen sink. And then I think I binged. I have to start over. And she said, all right, what did you eat? And I told her everything I ate. And she said, David, just stay on the train. And I think for me, sometimes people, you know, need to start over. For me, just being imperfect in that first year and having the permission to just keep going, that was really helpful for me. And, you know, I finished the 12 steps, and I think I've been through the 12 steps 7 times in the last 12, 13 years. And today I eat 3 meals a day with nothing in between. I weigh myself once a month. My body doesn't really change. My weight doesn't really fluctuate. You know, some months it's up a pound, some months it's down. But I have sanity with food today and with exercise and with body. I just don't want to overeat anymore. I live in a world where compulsive overeating is just not something that I do anymore. And that would have been the biggest miracle when I got here. Today, it's like the smallest miracle of my recovery. A couple of years into program, I got a sponsor who really wanted me to shine a light on my relationship with my dad. And, you know, when I got to my fourth step in that round, I looked at my part in relationships, and something that really became apparent to me was when people hurt me, I never let them back. I never forgave. I never knew how to like say, you know, when you did that thing to me, that really hurt my feelings. Instead, I just cut them out of my life and never talked to them again. That was a pattern that I did. And over the years, my dad really tried to make amends and really tried to show that he had changed and that he had done work, and I just never gave him a chance. He'd leave me a voicemail, I'd delete it, or I'd send an email about all the horrible things he did to me to punish him. And by the time I got to my eighth step in that round, I started praying for the willingness to forgive my dad, and I would pray every day. And then one day, intuitively, I found myself like buying a plane ticket to New York, and I had lunch with my dad, and we reunited, and, you know, we started to rebuild a relationship, and we didn't see each other for like 15 years, and that's a big gap of a father not having a son and a son not having a father. And for the last like 7 or 8 years, we have imperfectly found a way to have a relationship. And it's weird because I consider my dad one of the closest people in my life today. We talk like twice a week. I call him for advice. He gave the toast at my wedding. When I was going through a divorce, he really was there for me and gave me advice from his divorce. And it's just, that's God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. A couple years into our relationship, I took him to an OA meeting in Westchester, New York, and he raised his hand as a newcomer and said, you know, he's an addict and a compulsive overeater. And we started to share this thing in common. And it's just amazing what can happen when I just let go of everything that I think I know about the way that things are meant to go. I was not a committed person when I got here. Today I have 10-year friendships, 12-year friendships, long-term relationships. I have sponsees all across the country who look up to me, who I show up for on a weekly basis. And I have a beautiful life, and I have a great career that's been built with integrity and the principles of this program that is beyond my wildest dreams, like the miracles that happen in my career. That doesn't mean my life is easy, but I do have a design for living today that, regardless of what happens in my life, I know that there's a solution, and it's not food, and it's not any substance, and it's not anything outside of me. This has been the hardest personal year. This has been the best professional year of my life, the hardest personal year of my life. My soon-to-be ex-wife and I bought a house and moved across the country, and she had what I would consider some kind of psychotic break, and there was an affair, and there was a guy who she moved in with, and then there were crazy accusations about me, and my career reputation was just like everything that I feared in my life. Caring so much about what other people thought about me, I just had to surrender for about a two-month period. Every day, publicly, she was like posting 50 times a day on social media lies, and I just had to give it to God and just say, like, this is beyond me. There has to be a power greater than myself. And I got through that season thanks to recovery and thanks to sponsorship. And the cool thing about recovery is when you share problems in meetings, there's always somebody who knows somebody who went through it. And I found a group of guys who were like, you know, my wife ruined my life too. And I was walked through life with these guys and I got through it. And now I'm dating again. And it's like I get healed, and you know, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I'm just so grateful for who I've become thanks to this program. So thank you for letting me share. Okay. This is the time for questions only. There's no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any of us after the meeting. Please remember the opinions of the leaders are my own and not those of OA as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast.
Thank you for your share. You have had a rough year. What helped you the most in program to be centered and to be called and to be the person that you wanted to be?
So the question was, I've had a rough year. What helped me in program be calm and the person that I wanted to be? So when everything went down, I was living on the East Coast where, you know, I've been in LA for 15 years. This is really where my recovery community is, even though I do have a good community in New York. But my first thought when SHIT was really hitting the fan was I need to get back to LA. So I'm just so grateful for that intuitive thought. I moved back to LA and stayed with a fellow for a month and his wife. And that was really helpful. Like what I heard early on was you make the calls when things are good so that you're programmed when things are bad. And I've surrounded myself. My best friends are program people in this program and other programs. So I just knew to surround myself with recovery. I knew I needed to find a home group when I got back here. So I started going to light a candle. When I walked in, the speaker was like, oh, we need to get you to speak. And I was so fragile at that time. And I called my sponsor and was like, I don't want to speak. I think I'm going to cancel. And he's like, you have so much to offer in this moment. And I was like, okay. So I ended up, like, a couple weeks later leading Light a Candle, even though I didn't want to. And that really opened up my heart. And I was really taken back in by that group. And I've been going to that meeting ever since. And now all my sponsees go. And I feel like in those early years of recovery, when I was really in the center of the herd. So I did that. I exercise every morning. I wake up at 5 every morning. I meditate 20 minutes. That's a big part of my program, is the 11th step. I was always very wishy-washy about my 11th step practice. Like I would do 3 minutes or 5 minutes, or I'd check my phone. And I would always share, like, I want to be committed to meditation, but I didn't know how. And I did an outside thing that I paid for. And I think because I paid for it, for whatever reason, I became committed to it. And I haven't missed a 20-minute meditation since I did that. It's like the most non-negotiable part of my day is I wake up and I meditate for 20 minutes. It doesn't matter if I'm on the road. It doesn't matter if I'm in a hotel working. Wherever I am, I meditate for 20 minutes. And that's kind of what has walked me through. Calling sponsors, going to program, being of service, and like being a newcomer again. Yeah.
I didn't even recognize you when you came in. I thought, who's this guy? It was great to hear you, and I've heard you a number of times, but your childhood really spoke to me. And so when you say that you haven't eaten, is it because you feel like it won't help, or you just don't care?
Like eating compulsively?
Yeah.
So the question is, when I say I haven't eaten compulsively in recovery, is that because I know it won't help or that I just don't care?
Yeah.
You know, the AA literature says, like, we'll be placed in a position of neutrality. I really understand that now. It's not that I care or don't care, or know it'll help or not help. It's just like, I've just been placed in, I feel like, normalcy around food. Like, I know that if I eat sugar, it'll ruin my day. So I just don't eat it. And it's just like, it's just not, you know, I can carry a box of donuts to my assistants at work and could be in the car with me, and there's no part of me that's like, maybe I'll mess around. Like, it's just not anything that is in my world anymore. Yeah. You and then you.
Thanks for your share. Yeah, childhood triggers too. So I'm wondering, because you talked about the one time where you're doing your 9-step and you felt like you ate too much. Have you had any other times in the years intervening where you felt like maybe messed up a little bit or having issues, but didn't restart your abstinence?
Yeah, that one time, or the question is, were there any times in my recovery where I might have slept and didn't restart my abstinence?
Yeah.
Never with bulimia, never with diet pills. When I had about a year, I went on a 12-step trip to the Middle East. And there were no food options. And it was a weird day. But I called my sponsor and I said, like, this is the reality here. What do you want me to do? And I kind of walked through that day with him. And there might have been like flour in something I ate that day. But he was really like, David, it's the intention. And like once I was at a wedding and the bartender accidentally served me alcohol and I'm sober and I had a sip. And I called my sponsor and he said the same thing, like, it's the intention. So it's that. It's like, why am I doing it?
You talked about a feeling of calm when you eat the ice cream. What gives you that feeling now?
So the question is, what gives me the feeling of calm that I used to have when I ate the ice cream? Honestly, I think meditation, like a real consistent meditation practice. It's given me like a real pause in my life and a calm. And I work in a really stressful environment, but I'm just able to be way more calm than ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about your spiritual journey? Like, were you raised in a faith tradition? Did you have a strong faith growing up? Did you lose it? Did you come back to it? Like,
so the question is a little more about my spiritual journey. Was I raised in a faith? Did I lose it? So I was raised Jewish, and in my first 2 years of high school, I went to Catholic school. I don't know why. but it was interesting because I learned to pray there. You have to go to Mass every day. I started feeling really safe in church, but I got picked on. It was the time when there was a big movie that came out in the world, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism. So I was really picked on for being Jewish. I have a really like kind of Jewish last name, so I couldn't hide it. So I was ashamed, but in those years of going to Catholic school, I started to build a relationship with a higher power. And I grew up in a pretty open, spiritually minded house with my mom, even though she was very mentally ill. She would be the type of person who's like, I'm going to go to India for a month and live on an ashram with the hugging saint. And she would like do that. So, and there were always like that type of personality in my house. Like once there was a Buddhist monk living in my house for 6 months and I would like drive to school with her. Like Krishna Das, there were like chanting circles and meditation things happening in my house. So I grew up like around meditation and kind of alternative spirituality. So I was open when I came in here. It wasn't like I was like, if there's a God, why would I have the childhood that I had? But in my recovery, I explored a lot of different things. And what I believe my higher power is today is just this limitless source of love and light. But like I was just in New York City and I went to St. Patrick's Cathedral and like just sat there for 20 minutes. And that's where I feel, it's just weird. I have a very weird, kind of complicated but beautiful like idea of a higher power today. Michael.
Thanks, David. So I'm curious as to your relationship with your dad and how you spent years. I don't know if you've ever laid into him for what you thought was his part and just try to make him feel guilty and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And did your dad take it until you were able to pray for forgiveness? How did that talk about that?
So the question is, can I talk a little more about my relationship with my dad? Given what I went through, were there times where I really gave it to him? And did he take it? And kind of how did that evolve? So when I came into OA, I was very chip on my shoulder and would like, I was the type of person who I would go to Thanksgiving dinner and everybody was eating meat and I would play like PETA videos. Like I was just always like kind of an a-hole. So with my dad in my first couple years of recovery, I sent him this letter outlining all the horrible things he did. It was a brutal letter. I can show it to you if you want. But it was like, it was like every time you call, I get sick to my stomach. Like, it was like really bad. And he took it. And I later found out a couple years into recovery, he made an amends to me that was very heartfelt. And he wasn't making excuses, but he told me that he was abused by his dad. And he, you know, I didn't even know anything about his dad. And I kind of was like, there's a prequel to my movie. And I went through a period of recovery where I was really interested in that stuff. Like, what was your relationship with your dad? And I learned about my mom's relationship with her mom. And I learned when my mom was pregnant right before she had me, She got in a really bad fight with her mom, like, the day before she had me. So I've always had a really weird relationship with my grandma. Like, I just started to understand more where they came from, and it really helped guide me. But my dad told me he used to read that letter that I sent him every day. And it really, like, crushed him, but he really took it. And I don't know what he's done, but he's a different person. And I learned in program that it's a parent's job, hopefully, to teach a child how to live. I don't know if my dad did that, but it's a child's job to teach a parent how to die. And I've really just been there for my dad, and he's been there for me now. And we have a really kind of cool relationship. So, yeah, I never saw that coming.
I mean, you touched on this, but just to get, like, even more specific, give it to you. You know, just because your story is always so inspirational, it's heartbreaking that you had such highs and now are coming to such a low, or coming from such a low, especially with your relationship. So I'm wondering, how is it that you stay with what feels like these big disappointments, whether it's with careers or personal relationships, what, like, keeps you hopeful?
So the question is, what keeps me hopeful with kind of the highs and the lows that I've gone through in my life? I think being abstinent for 13 years, it's now a pretty significant body of work. They say it's an experiential program where I just kind of understand how my higher power works through me. And I know, just my experience of recovery is, I do have very low lows, and then there's always very high highs. That's just how my life has always worked. So I've had faith through this whole process that something good is gonna come from this. I've never been like, oh my God, I can't believe. I mean, I've gone through, it's been a crazy year, but there's always been optimism and hope that, like, it's going to lead me to something greater. And I just know that intuitively now. It's not like a sponsor has to tell me that. I just know that there's higher power in everything today. I think we have time for one more question.
2 minutes.
Yeah.
Why do bad things happen to good people?
The question is, why do bad things happen to good people? I mean, what is bad? You know, it's like, if I didn't grow up the way that I did, I wouldn't have found recovery when I was 21. I probably would have found it when I was in my 40s, so I'm grateful that I grew up the way that I did. I was in a really long-term relationship that I got blindsided in that one too. But I met my wife, my soon-to-be ex-wife, the next day. So, like, that thing led to something good. And now this thing that's going bad is going to probably lead to something good. So I don't look at things as good or bad anymore. It's just how I look at it. And pain is always the touchstone of spiritual growth. I also think pain is the touchstone of material growth and, like, worldly growth too. Like, I just know today that it's all good. Thank you for letting me share.
Now it's the time.